from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next on WBFO. I am your host, Jillian Hainsworth, and I'm joined today by a very special guest. So happy to have you. Today we have Rachel Laster, who is a dietitian and nutritionist and entrepreneur.
Yes.
She owns her own business called Real Life Dietetics and Consulting. She's also the program director of the Nutrition Empowerment Program at DeUville University. You got a lot going on.
A lot. Busy lady, but I enjoy all the work.
Yeah. And it's important work.
It is important work. There's a lack of information around nutrition, mm-hmm. especially for our underrepresented communities. So it's important work and truly why I did become a dietitian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually never knew a nutritionist or a dietitian. Like, well, growing up, I didn't even know that job.
I was informed in 2012 that there were no African-American dietitians in Buffalo.
Wow.
So I was like, oh. And around 2015, I decided to go back to school to become one.
Yeah. And where'd you go?
DeUville University, okay, become a dietitian. My first degree is from a million years ago at RIT. I'm actually the first black woman to receive a bioinformatics degree.
Okay, probably black history.
In America, but wow. I can't prove America. I can prove RIT. I can't prove America, but just given the nature of the timing, mm-hmm. it's probably the case.
That's huge.
It's a thing.
Well, congrats.
Like, thank you.
That's huge. I didn't know that. You need to put that on a t-shirt so people can know. So it's February.
Yes.
I feel like this is a time of year where people start to veer away from their New Year's resolutions. And I don't know anybody who doesn't have a resolution that involves getting healthier,
yes.
whether it's going to the gym, eating better, eating at home more.
Meditation, and,
right,
self-care.
Something that involves health.
Yes. And to your point, yes, it's people start falling off of their, if they chose to establish a better habit around something, this is often the time of year where they start to maybe fall off of those good habits. In regard to eating right, though, it's definitely, if you're trying to, you know, improve your health through food, it is good to maybe try to establish just a healthier diet. A lot of people do crash dieting, especially, you know, before the holidays or during the holidays or after the holidays, we want to assume these diets that are not necessarily the best laid plan. And it's best to assume a diet that is, you know, lifestyle management and mm-hmm. something that you can do long term as opposed to something that is super restrictive.
Yeah.
The New Year's resolutions often maybe put people on a path that isn't as sustainable as they would like, and so therefore that's why they end up dropping the healthy habit they may have started. Now, if you're doing something simple as, you know, maybe eating more vegetables or just incorporating more fruit or doing something like drinking more water, those are fine things to adopt, but often people are adopting diets that are very restrictive in calories mm-hmm. or completely cutting out carbohydrates or something like that. And those type of diets are not the best to follow as, once again, they're not sustainable long-term in most cases and don't really give people the long-term effects they want, but maybe some short-term effects.
Yeah. What about intermittent fasting? Like, is that healthy? Is that a good...
Intermittent fasting, well, it's not bad, or there's a dearth of a lot of research around it, and there's research in aspects of it, mm-hmm. and then there is some other research. So the research we have shows that there's almost no difference between just calorie restriction, regular okay. diet calorie restriction, and intermittent fasting in outcome. Mm-hmm. However, often intermittent fasting can help people stick to their calorie restriction goals.
Okay.
So often if you're someone who is, you know, snacking at night, and if you make yourself stop eating at 7, mm-hmm. then you stop doing even what we can consider maybe healthy snacks at night. Because if you have, like, oh, just a little crackers and peanut butter and here's some carrots and here's some fruit. Like, you're just doing these things constantly. That adds up. You know, even healthy snacks will add up into calories. Mm-hmm. And so you could very well overeat. So it helps people stop doing maybe those small meals or little small snacks as frequently. And so then they will actually adhere to whatever calorie restriction they would probably need to be on.
Yeah, because admittedly, so in my church, we fast every January.
Well, that's good.
So it helps me kick off the year strong. It's, you know, there's very strict times that you can eat. Mm-hmm. But then, like, by February when the fast is over, I'm, like, back to eating my sweet heat barbecue chips at night.
Well, to that point, people who are Muslim and practice Ramadan, you know, if they acknowledge their that holiday, you're not allowed to eat from what's sun up to sundown, correct?
Yeah.
And so that's pretty much just a textbook study of people doing intermittent fasting. And we have, you know, evidence that people will often overeat in both the times they're allowed to eat because of the nature of the fast. And so there's not as much overeating in the beginning part, but often at the evening part, the evening meal, people will overeat to compensate for the fact that they didn't eat all day. And and then often if there is weight loss during that time, we see people gain the weight back.
Gain the weight right.
Yeah. Ugh, fasting is not a bad idea. It's just, it can be a tool.
Yeah.
It can be a tool in your toolbox of things to lose weight, but really, the best thing is to figure out firstly what you like to eat, how you like to eat, and then also like what your needs are and match your eating patterns to that as best you can. So because if you have a health condition or a chronic disease or something of that nature, you do have to watch what you're eating more so than someone who doesn't have those things.
Yeah.
And it's sort of important to make sure that you are understanding what your intake is. So I often, when I work with clientele, if they're not tracking what they're eating, I do ask they at least start it for about a week or so, or just try to see, and just do it in whatever method they think is most appropriate. If you need an app, go ahead. If you want to, you know, just write it down on a piece of paper, go ahead. But the best thing to do is to track it in some form or format for at least about a week, just so you can actually get a realistic idea of what you're eating. Because even like your intention can be, you know, you might think you're eating very well. You're not overeating. You're not undereating. You might think you're in a certain area. Mm-hmm. And you may be far off from where you think you are in terms of calorie intake. And as much as it's not as cut and dry as calories in, calories out in terms of weight loss and or weight gain, it sort of also is that basic.
Yeah.
But like I said, we have a lot of people who just think they're eating less. Like, I can't, it's me myself, admittedly. I was like, oh, well, I'm not overeating. And I actually, you know, ran the numbers. And I was like, yes, I am. Like, because I eat, if you've seen my, like, Facebook page or whatever.
Yeah, you always have the best meal.
Like, I eat rather healthy meals. But I would notice, like, I'll also don't post, like, at that point in time, I've cut myself off from as frequently doing this. But I used to go to, like, get, like, a cupcake or a cookie or have like something sweet, because I have a sweet tooth. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would eat those things and not really count them in the way that, in the calorie amount that they really probably should have been counted in. And so I'm like, so as much as I didn't think I was overeating, because I'm eating these really healthy meals, like, you know, all vegetables and salads and, you know, salmon and all these just good things, I was probably overeating in the sugar category a bit. It helps you be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And like, not that you're trying to be dishonest with yourself, it's just a matter of it helps you be more honest and just be aware of what your intake is. And then that helps me work with the clientele, if they are tracking, to, you know, see where they can make changes, what changes they are best for them to make. Because a lot of people as well may not know the amount of nutrients you need.
Yeah.
Like, for women, women need about 60 to 65 grams of protein a day. And that's pretty much through your lifespan, after you're adult. You know, and men need about 70 to 75 grams minimum. These are minimum amounts a day. And so I've had some clientele that will be eating all their calories, but maybe only eating 30 grams of protein a day.
Yeah.
So that's not sufficient. So it helps me help them understand, like, where they need to make changes, and also, like, help them understand, you know, where they need to make changes, so I can, like, relate information to them more appropriately. But I also noticed this also with our elderly community, because as you age, you need less of some things. your protein needs for stay the same, but your want to eat diminishes just from aging. Like your need right. to eat changes. So especially with our elderly members, we have to make sure that they're still trying to keep their protein up. And that's much more difficult if you're only eating two meals a day. You know, like older people, they'll be like, oh, I just had some tea and toast and mm-hmm. I had, you know, some soup. And I'm like, okay, that's not sufficient. You're like, so you have to like work with it. And so that's why often they have to drink those things like Ensure mm-hmm. or something of that nature, because they need to meet those protein needs. That doesn't really change as much as you age, but like so your need for like water would go down as you age a little bit, your liquid needs, but that doesn't change. So since your protein needs don't change, we really need our elderly members to our elderly, you know, community members to be aware of that and understand that they need to, like, if they're going to be eating, that since their appetite has dwindled, that they should prioritize things that have protein in it. So, you know, meat, like if they must, canned tuna, mm-hmm. you know, other types of seafood. We try to ask people to stay away from, you know, what traditionally more cultural dishes in as frequently, not yeah. at all, like, but as frequently, like, you know, African-American cultures, we have some dishes that are a little bit more caloric than other things.
Yeah, but they're the best ones.
No, they can be very delicious. and I'm a dietitian that likes to help people understand that all foods do fit.
Yeah.
It's just you have to consider volume and quantity and like frequency. So I like to work with people and have them understand that they can have these things. It's just they might want to consider how much of it they're having, like how often. Like Thanksgiving is a wonderful meal, but we shouldn't have Thanksgiving dinner 4 days in a row. Like that's not the greatest way to, you know, like have long-term effects of health. I very much am a fan of repurposing food. Mm-hmm. So for our CURLS, which is an organization here that was centered around helping women cancer survivors, I did a Thanksgiving like repurposing of leftovers webinar mm-hmm. Cooking class. So we took the sweet potato pie, we turned that into chickpea and sweet potato dish, or candied yams, and turned that into chickpea and sweet potato dish. We took the turkey and just made turkey salad because that was mm-hmm. We took the collard greens and turned it to, if you're familiar with callaloo and saltfish,
oh, yeah.
it's a common Caribbean dish. We did a collard green and saltfish type dish mm-hmm. and I also, you can't improve macaroni and cheese. Like, you can't improve it health-wise, so just eat less. Like, it's delicious. Just eat it, enjoy it. And I did something else. I can't remember what it was. But we did, so I like to help people understand that they can take these leftovers and do maybe other things that may be a little healthier with it instead of just eating in a natural state.
Yeah.
Fried chicken is fried chicken. I can look, we can talk for hours and hours on the variances of food. However, fried chicken is good. Mm-hmm. Just don't eat a lot of it. Like,
yeah.
there's protein. There's too much fat if you consider the fat content. But we have a lot of people who are, you know, very, like, super interested in veganism or something these days. And mm-hmm. they'll still have a fried mushroom.
It's still
fried. Like, yeah. So the issue really is the frying, not the content. And if you are someone who maybe is a diabetic or an older person, like I said, we need that protein. And you're not going to find that protein in that mushroom.
Right.
Like, so while this is healthier in a way, it may not be healthier for your needs. And so it's really important to maybe either work with a dietitian or just understand what your needs are so that you can make those choices.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to pivot, but I have mm-hmm. one question
oh,
first.
Please go ahead.
Before we do. Are there such thing as good sugars and bad sugars?
Not really. So all sugar is sugar. Now that's also like we're considering what are your conditions. So honey is not better than table sugar unless you are considering the antioxidant content.
Okay.
So if we're focusing on glucose, sugar is sugar. All sugar, like raw sugar, turbinado, brown, you know, like honey,
sugar.
Agave, all these sugars are sugar. Your body's going to react to it the exact same way. It's going to break it all down to the exact same glucose. Now, there are benefits to honey in a way where it does provide antioxidants. So if that's what your goal is, you want some antioxidants with your sugar, go ahead. That's fine. It's really, you still want to watch the volume of sugar you're using. There's not, this one sugar is not going to be significantly better than another sugar. People are like, you know, I don't have that white table sugar. I just have I just raw I like sugar. Raw sugar.
Yeah,
it's sugar. Your body has no idea there was a difference. there's no difference. To that point of vegan desserts, I had a friend insist that this vegan cookie was significantly better than another cookie. And I was like, the problem with cookies is not the milk or the egg per se. It would be the sugar content. And so if we're gonna have a villain in this situation, it would be the sugar content, and that usually doesn't change. Like Oreos are vegan. I wouldn't call Oreos particularly healthy. Delicious, yes, but not healthy. So you have to consider like what we're being marketed in terms of health, mm-hmm. and like the buzzwords people are using to make you purchase things that really won't be beneficial in the way you may think they would be.
So we know that Buffalo is really unique. Mm-hmm. You are very active in the community in like a lot of different ways. You're a part of a lot of different community groups, a lot of community facing work. Yeah. So in 2022, we know that we had a mass shooting at Tops, the only grocery store in a black mm-hmm. community in the city of Buffalo. And
very unfortunate.
It caused for a month mm-hmm. the grocery store to shut down, which obviously was a lack of resources. Mm-hmm. I like to use food apartheid and not food desert because a lot of this is systemic and intentional.
It's systemic and intentional, very much so, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I want to ask first how you felt about the efforts to provide the community, especially 14208, with like nutrition and like mm-hmm. food resources post May 14th.
Yes. So I actually have to applaud all the organizations that did come together because the nature of that area, like you said, food desert, food apartheid, there is a big issue around that, mm-hmm. Especially in several areas of Buffalo, because if you aren't someone with the transportation to go to an area where you can get something better, this is where you have to shop.
Yeah.
So in terms of the efforts put forth, and that was a lot of, community different organizations like African Heritage Food Co-op, mm-hmm. Feed Buffalo, and several others. If I did not mention you, do not charge it to my head and not my heart. There were so many organizations that did reach out and create an ecosystem over there that unfortunately was not getting the attention it deserved prior.
Yeah.
So the food, the nature of food access in Buffalo isn't great.
Yeah.
At least to healthy, what we call healthy foods, and I'm thinking in particular fresh produce. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people here now doing the work. We have so many organizations that are doing the work to help improve that. Like we have, Buffalo Go Green as well, the organization we mentioned earlier. Providence Farm Collective, mm-hmm. MAP. There's so many organizations that are trying to help increase the need, the access to fruits and vegetables in Buffalo. So we have a lot of people doing that work, and that is good. So I'm glad that work is happening. In regards to the shooting and the efforts afterwards, it did elucidate for a lot of other individuals in the community, though, the need for education around mm-hmm. eating healthier, as well as just the lack of access prior. Like, unfortunately, our communities were very much ignored. Mm-hmm. So since they were ignored, we had individuals of the mind to do the work prior, they were trying to build a market.
Yeah.
I love that Truly Rooted Market is where it is over on Fillmore now. Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful store, as well as Salud over on Main. Like, we have stores that are now much more in that area, and I think also potentially may have gotten funds for that. I have no idea exactly. But I think it helped show people the need for better access to these vegetables. Vegetables and fruit and produce in general, and healthy eating in a sense. We also have so many urban gardens. So those individuals help people learn to create their own food. Now, I have no green thumb. I tried. I gave up. So I appreciate them for at least trying to teach and helping people, but also creating even more access. Because at the end of the day, as much as we do just shop at stores most of the time, we can learn to take care of ourselves in a way. And also, there are very few things I say globally as a dietitian that will improve your health. But the only two things I do say are drink more water and eat more vegetables. Yeah. And so since those are two things that I think are very important and can pretty much apply across the board, access to those things, I feel, is very important.
So for the people who may not still have access to those things regularly, whether that's because of the location they live in comparison to the closest real grocery store that has fresh produce, or finances, you know, we have a really high population now of people from other countries who may not be eligible for certain social services. What tips can you give people to try to eat more vegetables, drink more water, you know, make healthier choices when they don't necessarily have the same access?
Yes. Okay. Well, I mean, there are some food pantries that you can that are supported by, you know, Feed More or other organizations that can provide you with, you know, that have access to fresh fruit and vegetables. I know Harvest House would be one. Provisions 139. That's over on the west side. They would be some food pantries that you could attend. But if you don't have access to those, because once again, that's still a transportation issue, or at least where you are located issue often. So if you don't have money for food, I imagine you don't have a car. I'm assuming you may. I would say, like, there's ways to sort of stretch food. Canned food gets vilified, and it is very salty in comparison, but you can, like, the utilization of canned food, you can, like, rinse vegetables off. And then, like, if you rinse them, you can still use them in soups and things of that nature. If you have fresh fruit and vegetables, I would never throw anything away. Mm-hmm. What you should do is when you see it starting to maybe get less fun, just freeze it. Like just because you can turn it into soup. Soup is a very easily stretchable food. Our canned beans are a very good source of protein. Our canned vegetables are still a good source of fiber and minerals and all those things that vegetables provide. Just like I said, the preserving methods are salty. So we do ask that if you are using canned vegetables, to try to rinse them, like, before you utilize them. Mm-hmm. Frozen vegetables, people have asked me, like, are frozen vegetables as good as fresh? Sometimes they're better. You really don't know, because frozen vegetables often get picked and then frozen. So they retain that nutrient content. When we have our vegetables in store, we don't necessarily know how long they've been, like, how long, where they came from, how long they were in the truck, how long they got in the storage room, how long they've been out. So they could have essentially lost some more nutrients than your frozen vegetables. And frozen vegetables are often a very cost-efficient method of getting your nutrients in as well. So if you can't afford fresh, but we do, we have a lot of stores, we have a lot of efforts, a lot of community efforts to help provide people. I know Saturday Academies are doing the free farmers markets. So there's a lot of efforts around in Buffalo that I'm glad people can access. It's just maybe giving more education around where they are, make sure people know that they exist.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think one of the biggest issues when it comes to community awareness is just that when we're such a segregated community, unless you are located near the resource, you may not know it exists at all.
You may not know. And so there's probably some more work to be done on that effort to make sure that many years ago, I was like, there needs to be one person in charge of all this to disseminate this information so that people won't be working in silos and people won't be doing, like, at least the nutrition efforts, but to the nature of the work, unfortunately, it's very much grant-led in most cases. And I don't know how you're familiar with grants or not, but it can be, like, it's a lot of duplication of effort because of the nature of the way the work is paid for.
Right.
And so since there's, like, oh, the one person's doing this over here, but now it's cut off, and now someone else is over here doing this, and now that's cut off, and now someone over here is doing this. It's very similar, but now that's cut off. And so since the nature of it being grant-led and somewhat confusing, that also, I think, leads to why people may not be able to know that something's happening. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we could do some better effort and maybe make sure that people are aware of the beneficial things to them in the community.
Are there any other myths about food and eating that you hear that just, like, grinds your gears when you hear it?
The water, the alkaline water. Oh, like, no. You don't need that. I do like to tell people to save money. Like, I'm very big on teaching recipes and doing community classes. And just when I do those classes, I try to give recipes that are firstly affordable and then lean people away from doing things that aren't to their benefit. So once again, like, you can pay more for water if you'd like, or you could just drink water. like there's not going to be any actual science that supports alkaline water being better for you. No shade to Dr. Sebi's diet. It's a perfectly fine diet. However, it is not accurate in the science behind why it would be a good diet. And it's much more restrictive than it needs to be, because some of the things he's saying don't eat, you can perfectly well eat and be fine. Mm-hmm. That's not how mucus works in your body. that's not conceptually how it works. But if you were to eat and follow that plan, you wouldn't probably find any particular issue with the diet. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not doing what he says it does.
I could talk for days.
Yeah, huh? I could probably, like, prebiotics. If someone there's nothing wrong with it. Probiotics are a thing. I would suggest you just buy some yogurt. I wouldn't suggest you pay, like, unless you want to buy something more advanced and you actually know you have a diagnosed issue within your colon that requires more more of a pharmaceutical method of a probiotic, you're probably fine just eating something
but
like
that. But you can yogurt. Find a lot of things like, in
yeah,
food, right?
Yeah, you find a lot of things in food. So people talk about prebiotics now, which is just a fancy word for fiber. You don't need to purchase those. Like, so if you're seeing something marketing that to you, you don't need to buy that. You can just eat more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and you will get more prebiotics in your diet. It's really just truly a fancy word for fiber. We don't need to do a lot of things. Really, anything that says like keto, just about on it, unless you are someone diabetic and in need of a lower carbohydrate item, you probably don't need to buy that. However, if you're someone that does want to increase their fiber intake, those breads and like those type of products are often higher in lower in carbohydrate and higher in fiber. So you have to look at your labels. Nutrition label reading is super important, and a lot of people just don't do it. And that's where your source of truth, in a sense, is going to be. Now, it can be off by about 20% in either direction legally. Mm-hmm. So, but in most cases, that's just for the sake of. And that's mostly the case of restaurants, because you know if you're scooping food onto something, that's you can't really measure that fully and know exactly what's in there. But in terms of what you're seeing in the market, that number and those things does have to be, that's regulated, you know, that in a sense. Like, so it's important to read your labels, because that'll give you what's in your food. And so it gives you that much more information. You know your protein content, you know your fat content is, and you know what your carbohydrate content will be, and protein. And so these things are all important to know, especially if you're trying to do that tracking, especially if you're trying to just do like to meet your needs. And that's important for people to do and know. To that point, I feel like there's some things I should say that people should know. So in terms of water intake, I've noticed that some people don't drink enough water. And this is a lot of people, not just some, like a lot of people don't drink the right amount of water. They drink some water and they're like, I've had this one 16 ounce bottle a day. That's not sufficient. You need a minimum 4 16 ounce bottles a day, mm-hmm. Unless you're, like I said, older. But so you need 64 ounces or so of water a day minimum. And then more than that's good. You don't necessarily need that gallon. Now that's a lot. That's about two. That's okay. That's more than you would need. But I do like to help people, like to the point, drink more water, eat more vegetables. To that point as well. So we as dietitians support this thing called, propose like our government thing, My Plate. So we ask people to eat about half a plate of vegetables and fruits, non-starchy. So, and then about a quarter of their plate be carbohydrates. So rice, pasta, starchier vegetables like potatoes, corn, things of that nature. And 1/4 of our plate be protein. About any 3 to 4 ounce item of protein, mm-hmm. would be about 20 grams of protein. So we say, and by protein, we prefer lean proteins like chicken breast, turkey, just about any seafood. Seafoods are going to be a much lower fat, mm-hmm. Way to get to the same protein goal, or protein amount than our meat sources. But if you can't eat any of those or choose not to eat any of those, you can always do things like beans, lentils, tofu, if you're interested in learning to cook that, because a lot of people aren't as familiar with tofu. But those are all plant-based sources of the same protein.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. I just learned so much. I've been doing it wrong, guys. I gotta go home and adjust. But I really appreciate having you, and I hope that we can have you back at some point, because I think these conversations are so crucial in our communities. Before we leave, for people who want your services, who want to learn more, who want to sit down and figure out what they need specifically, how can they find you?
They can find me at reallifedietconsulting.com or at they could just give me a call at 716-812-1577.
So you heard that if you want to improve your diet and you want to make a real lifestyle change for you, for your family, your community, make sure you get in touch with Rachel. I know I will, because I just learned so much. We can't keep eating our Thanksgiving leftovers that long, y'all. So let the leftovers go. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
More What's Next to come after this brief message.
Public media is your gateway to discovery. From investigative journalism on Frontline to live local performances on WNED Classical and tiny stage sessions from WBFO The Bridge, Buffalo Toronto Public Media connects you to the stories, music, and moments that matter most. Explore what we have to offer at WNED.org. This is Public Media.
PBS Learning Media provides free learning resources like our series, Compact History. Follow Corey, a time-traveling middle school history teacher, as he journeys beyond your textbook. Learn how history surrounds us and includes you, and find activities and tools to expand your knowledge. Check out the Compact History Collection on pbslearningmedia.org.
Hey folks, Corey here with Compact Civics. I'm convinced there's something in the water in Buffalo, New York. Sure, maybe it's the Niagara River with all those minerals, but this city is known for more than snowy winters and chicken wings. It's full of standout political talent. Buffalo is a hotbed of U.S. presidential politics. Millard Fillmore, our 13th president, hails from there. And Grover Cleveland was mayor of Buffalo, governor of New York, and a U.S. president. On a somber note, William McKinley was assassinated in 1901 while visiting the Pan American Exposition, but that led to Theodore Roosevelt taking his oath of office in Buffalo. This city has given us prominent figures like the trailblazing Shirley Chisholm, the first African American congresswoman and presidential candidate. Buffalo's civic spirit doesn't stop there. Others include Neil Abercrombie, former governor of Hawaii, and Kathy Hochul, governor of New York. And we can't forget about Frances Folsom Cleveland and Abigail Fillmore, both first ladies. Or pioneers of equal rights like Winifred C. Stanley, who introduced the first equal pay legislation. Buffalo's impact on leadership and civic dedication is off the charts. If the city of good neighbors keeps it up, maybe someday we can be known as the country of good neighbors.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Today on What's Next, more of my conversation with artist Jay Carrier. Born on the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve, Jay Carrier has lived most of his life in Niagara Falls. Now, 61 years old, his massive body of mostly abstract work is gaining attention.
My actual real name was given name from my father, and it's Hubert Carrier. Hubert Carrier.
Oh, okay.
That's how you kind of pronounce it in French. But everybody called me Jay when I was very young, because nobody liked my father. So my grandfather titled me J.R. It was Junior. And everybody caught on to it just as Jay. But some of my brothers and stuff, they'll call me Hugh or Hubert. And but most of my friends and everything call me Jay.
And let's be honest, the name Jay is outstanding.
It flows just a little bit better. That's actually my given name in the Longhouse.
Printed up here? Yeah.
Yeah.
Come with you, yeah.
And that's my given name in the Longhouse, Dagahatwe. He paddles his canoe.
Oh.
And that's an Onondaga that was given to from my clan mother. My grandmother was the clan mother of our nation, the Wolf Clan.
You know, it's interesting talking to you. You know, we talked before about growing up here in Niagara Falls, and you were pretty young when you came here.
Yeah. About 3 and a half. Yeah.
So, okay. So, yet you carry your native heritage with you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, my mother made sure that would happen.
Yeah.
She was a faith keeper in our nation. She was going to be a clan mother. She wasn't. Her sister was. But she was a very valuable source of, they call it the old ways. And the old ways were the longhouse ways. And she knew all the ceremonies and everything. So she was teaching people the languages. She knew, I believe, four languages out of the Six Nations. And she was teaching Onondaga, which was her clan, language.
Jay Carrier spoke reverentially about his mother, her many skills, her ability with native language, and how she journalized daily activities with minute detail.
I've always said that this what I'm doing is my language. It's my own personal language. This is me doing what my mother was doing, but translating it in a visual sense. And being honest about who I am and where I grew up, I talk about everything, even non-native issues, just human issues sometimes. And of course, human issues transcends, peoples.
A studio overflowing with paintings and drawings, Jay Carrier walks me through some of the works. One particular piece that was painted on wood shelving contained ample personal meaning.
So Leave Us by the River is a reference to my mother bringing us to Niagara Falls and raising us in Niagara Falls away from the reservation. And the fire that grew so low was a reference to some of the hard times we had. The reason why we moved here, so we move, because our father was being abusive to our mother, and she wanted to not raise her children in that environment, so we moved. So this was a piece, a kind of somber piece that said we had to move away from this person, and we moved by the river of Niagara Falls, and it wasn't a good experience, the fire that grew so low.
That's
just piece of the story.
Sure.
You could see I was fairly prolific.
Yes.
I'm just sorting through some of these drawings, and I think I'm about a quarter of the way through, and I'm trying to archive them because this gallery in New York told me you better start taking care of your work because it's relevant. Everything that you make is relevant because of the stage it's going on. So I started putting them in these plastic archival sleeves. And I've already done 160. And I think I'm about a quarter of the way through my drawings.
Just drawings. Not the many paintings that I see about here on the walls and leaning up on the walls.
Not the drawings.
Yeah.
And a lot of the work I've made throughout the last 20 years, I would say half of it wasn't even shown, because a lot of the work I make in here, I'll put back there, and it doesn't see the light of day. It just goes back in that whatever. That's why I have so much work. I didn't have time to pursue that that second part of being an artist as far as promoting it, selling it. And I'm not saying that I didn't do shows. I did shows along the way, but it wasn't at it wasn't my occupation, so to speak. I worked in industry in Niagara Falls for the last 25 years, and I finally retired.
Before he retired, Jay Carrier worked in the chemical industry, giving him a keen understanding of the realities of what was being produced, its environmental impact, and how the many industrial facilities provided jobs to the people of Niagara Falls. Even when he was working, Jay Carrier would spend as much time as he could in his studio, painting and creating. Saving most of the work may prove of great value as outside interest grows. Jay Carrier's work was recently shown in New York City at the 42nd Canal Gallery, and another exhibition has been showing in recent weeks at the Buffalo Art Studio.
It's about the Niagara River, my interpretation of the Niagara River. Niagara, It's Great to Be Here was the original small painting. I think it was 24 by 24. It was a smaller piece. Was a self-portrait of me. I worked in industry cleaning some of the messes that these people, our forebears, made. It was a chemical cleaning company, and I had to dress up in all this gear to clean these pipes and these tanks and whatnot. That was my job. And I knew, you know, I'm sitting here like, I can't work on this. I can't be in this, you know, to do this the rest of my life. I just can't do this. And ironically, my wife and I were going down the Robert Moses Parkway, and I realized what was in this plant. I'm not going to name the plant.
Sure.
I realized what was in this plant because I was intimately involved in cleaning some of the places up around it. And it said, there was this big sign on the side of this tank that held some kind of chemical in it. And it said, Niagara, It's Great to Be Here. And I think, how freaking ironic is that?
Oh.
You know, Niagara, It's Great to Be Here. You polluted out half of Niagara Falls. Your company, because you inherited that, doesn't mean it's your, it's still your responsibility and liability. But we know you didn't do it, but you're still responsible for that contamination, Love Canal, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's other places in Niagara Falls that were their responsibility.
Right.
And I thought, how ironic. And I made that painting right after that. And I said, that's incredible that's how they think. That's how they're trying to bamboozle people, thinking that they're doing a good thing. But on the flip side of that, this company employed hundreds of people that raised their families in and around Niagara Falls to sustain their life. You know, they were raising people from these wages and these plants. And when that was taken away, them families moved out of here from Love Canal and from the Niagara Falls area. And I thought, so it works both ways.
Yeah.
But then I worked in a chloralkali place over here on Buffalo Avenue. And, you know, there was still a lot of talk about these chemical factories. And I know personally that they didn't pollute because of the EPA. I knew personally, because if they did, I wouldn't have worked there that long. I worked 21 years. And I come to see the hypocrisy and what people deem as chemicals, because the floors we walk on, the shoes we wear, the foods that we eat, them chemicals that we make are all of that, and it's all about you. So that's hypocrisy. You rely on the clean water that we drink. You rely on so many things that these chemicals are in, and you don't realize it, that's why they make these chemicals for, you know, the cleanliness of our waterways, the cleanliness of your dish soaps, your everything, laundry detergents, you name it. It's made here. But you just don't know it in its raw form, that it's in these chemicals that you use every day.
And then the other paintings that ended up at the Buffalo Art Studio, I mean, did they fall into that theme, or are you leaving it to the curator to follow?
Well, it weaves in and out of that. It weaves. It's not, because the whole show wasn't directly geared towards that idea of the politicalness of the chemicals that exists, excuse me, within our waterways and environment. The idea was that the person that made these pieces lived in the history that you're talking about, intimately in the environment, in the social sphere, the place that you're talking about. This wasn't just on paper. This was a person living through that. So I knew both sides of this. I knew the political side of the Love Canal mess. I knew the cleanup side. So I knew intimately what these plants were and what they did and what we were doing and we inherited all this stuff. I knew the other side of this, where there's a plant in Niagara Falls that I work for that actually were stewards of our environment, and it's a chemical plant. And I said to myself, if you only knew, you know, the beauty of what they did. They cleaned up this place, you know, because of the EPA regulations, of course. But they still, they held to their word that they were not going to pollute Niagara waterways out. And so that would allowed me, you know, the idea that I could continue working for you, because I wouldn't have worked for them if we were doing stuff like that. I would never want to be on the other end of that, the other side of that.
I think you may have kind of answered my final question about the Buffalo Art Studio show. Mm-hmm. When people come to see it, what do you want them, how should they approach it? I mean, I know everybody has their own way of doing it, but it sounds like, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. you've got a history inside these paintings that it seems like it should be known as a viewer's taking a glance at it.
Yeah, it works on many levels, because as I said, I grew up in Niagara Falls. I had a great upbringing, and I knew intimately the rivers. I swam in them. I fished in them. I enjoyed the camaraderie that many of the local people I grew up with enjoyed the rivers, as I did. I looked at it as a place of sanctity, the Niagara Gorge specifically. I looked at it as a place of healing, and I looked at it as a place of enrichment to the whole society that Niagara Falls exists in. It's just that nobody wants to tap into it, and I'm glad they don't, because they leave it alone for the most part, meaning the Niagara Gorge specifically. So I knew it on many different levels, and because it was my history, growing up downtown, of course, I knew the people, and I thought the people were more important than the falls themselves. The people were more important than the rivers, because they lived here and they lived through this stuff. And they know, and I know, that Niagara Falls is a great city. It just has to be, taken care of in a good manner. And I can't say that it's being taken care of in a good manner currently.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
WBFO's Disabilities Beat helps us understand our community's challenges.
I don't think that people understand how exhausting it is to be disabled, because you're fighting on so many fronts all the time just to exist.
Sign up for Protect My Public Media to ensure initiatives like this remain strong. Go to protectmypublicmedia.org today and make your voice heard.
This is Jack Cruiser with the scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of the scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Celebrate the 50th anniversary season of Austin City Limits. Don't miss remarkable performances from Gary Clark Jr., Black Pumas, Brittany Howard, and more. Watch every Monday at 10 p.m. on WNED PBS.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
On What's Next, we're hearing more of my recent conversation with artist Jay Carrier. After working professionally in industry for most of his adult life while doing art on the side, he is now retired and has more time to devote to his work. And a lot of that is going through the decades of art that he has stockpiled. As we've heard, Jay Carrier is forthcoming, not only about his hometown of Niagara Falls, but also about other Indigenous artists and their collective influence on modern art. Here's more with Jay Carrier. This is What's Next.
As, you know, as a contemporary artist, of course, I'm painting in the moment, but I'm reflecting on the history of who I am also. So there's different levels that you could look at these paintings from. You could look at it from a historical place. You could look at it from a compositional place. You could look at it from an emotional place. You could look at it from, you know, I don't like it place, or however you want to look at it. Like, I could talk about this painting for an hour today and come back tomorrow and have a whole different story because I'm talking from a different place of view.
Hmm.
So, and I do that because I want the viewer, because many viewers have different, they don't know. They could interpret this any which way they want. So the viewer comes to a painting and they have their own opinions on what they're seeing and what they're looking at and expressions. And I would like to think that the viewer can interpret it and leave it as an open interpretation of what they're viewing so that they feel comfortable with what they're doing and what they're interpreting, because it's theirs and theirs personal. And if I could touch a person where it's a personal place that they go to while viewing one of my paintings, then I did my job as an artist. You know, I made an impact on that person. Whether it's negative or positive, it doesn't matter. I still made an impact. And the way I look at these paintings that I do is, once they leave me, I'm not going to be around these paintings when they show in these different places. Once they leave me, they still gain a history. So I'm not there to speak about what this is. There's words that go with this, maybe in a introduction to the show, but it's an abstract piece, and it's going to garner a lot of activity, meaning people are going to come to it with different perspectives, and I like to leave that open, and I like to think that the piece itself interprets and internalizes from these viewers as much as they're getting. The piece starts creating its own history. So if this piece goes to 10 different shows, it could be shown with 10 different meanings, and the mythology starts to work in its effect.
I want to return to a conversation we had off mic before, and I thought it was curious. And we were talking about how Indigenous artists, there seems to be, the world of art seems to be opening up in recent times. Mm-hmm. Art isn't new to Indigenous people, but that world of art that is in galleries and in museums seems to be really opening up and connecting with.
Well, I think the whole thing with climate change, I think climate change has cued everybody that, you know, this stuff that we're living in is not permanent, and that we have to maintain and take care of, you know, the natural beauties that we're surrounded by, or we might not have them. Hopefully we will in generations and generations. But the way things are going now in the political climate, we might not have that too much longer. So I think because of that idea that Native people were inherently kind of the custodians of this philosophy of natural beauty, I think it came to more light, especially in the spheres of art. I think that's what happened.
And then finally, I think you dated yourself 61 years old.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you can be doing this for decades to come?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I hope so. I hope one of my last days that I exist is in a studio painting. I hope that happens, yeah. I'll forever be doing this. I've done it since I was a little boy, making drawings out of comic book characters in a closet. when I was 4 or 5 years old. I remember that, and I have drawings from that. So I hope that, you know, as far back as my memory goes, and as blessed as I was since then, that I can continue doing it right to my my final days.
And it seems, I'm following up with my final question with another question, of course, but it seems to me you're very intuitive that you know, the moment comes to you and you follow it, and you've even told me, like, this particular painting here may have been in 5 or 6 different sessions putting it together. Mm-hmm. But are there areas that you want to explore that you intentionally want to continue to move toward?
Well, what I don't want to do, I could tell you what I don't want to do. I don't want to be pigeonholed into some kind of genre of painting. I don't want to be considered this or that kind of painter. So I leave it open to interpretation. Whether it goes on in my historical legacy, one of these days, it'll be that. That I wasn't just an indigenous Native American artist, that I was a great artist that was an American.
Jay Carrier, thanks for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's great.
We've been listening to more of my recent conversation with artist Jay Carrier, conducted in his studio in Niagara Falls. Jay Carrier's work is on display right now at an exhibition, Niagara, It's Great to Be Here, at the Buffalo Art Studio at the Tri-Maine Center. This is What's Next on WBFO.